So, hello, constant listeners, and welcome to the podcast formerly known as the Kai Draconis Books Podcast. Now, since Kai Draconis Books is no longer going to be publishing, and that name was maybe never a great indicator of the contents of the pod, we thought now would be a good time for a rebrand. So from now on, we're going to be calling this podcast Book Spider, which we envision as being not just a creature that weaves together connections between texts, but one that does so in a deliberate and purposeful and delicately calibrated way. You know, we've always taken a lot of pride in this pod for being serious-minded, for being unafraid to talk about things in the most intellectual register possible. A podcast for, not to be snobs or anything, but for the discriminating and intelligent listener. Not the kind of podcast where we have a segment on what beer to drink when you read the book. And those values will continue. Today we're going to be talking about Consuay's Love in the New Millennium, which is a novel that covers the experiences of a series of, maybe appropriately enough, interweaving stories of different men and women experiencing love and sex and romance in contemporary-ish China. And this is a sinnerless novel. It's one whose underlying mechanisms are somewhat unclear, and all three of us, frankly, were a bit stymied by it. We're going to be grappling with it today. So normally, this is the part where I would give some kind of a synopsis of what happens in Love in the New Millennium, right? But this is, I think, a book which is fairly difficult to summarize. You know, it's not so much because it is slippery at a line or paragraph or sentence level, right? Like, it's pretty easy to tell bit to bit what's happening, page to page even what's happening. But the further that you get from the sentence level, the more slippery, I think, the arcs of the characters become, the more slippery the chains of events become, right? This is a surprisingly difficult novel to read and to think about, right? Just to kind of think about the broad structure of it, you know, there's a series of characters who all have a series of characters who live in contemporary China who all have various kinds of interrelated romances, love affairs, you know, transactional sexual interactions. And there are 10 chapters, I think 10, sorry, 11 chapters, and each of those chapters focuses on either a different relationship or a different individual within that cast of characters. But most of those people appear throughout the book, right? And sometimes they're viewpoint characters, other times they're not. And I don't know that I can really pull out any kind of central character. I don't know that I can really pull out any particular, I don't know that I can pull out any particular individual that you would think of as a protagonist precisely. I'm not sure that I can isolate anybody whose story or whose arc matters any more than anybody else's. Just, you know, a few characters that come to mind. There's a widow named Quilan who's having an affair with a man named Wei Bo, who goes to prison at some point. Wei Bo has been having an affair in the past with a sex worker named Ah Si. The Wei Bo is married to somebody named Xiao Yuan, who he has kind of a passionless, essentially an open marriage with, right? Just for not so much in the sense that we would think of it in the West, but more so just because it's a very kind of loveless marriage where they both allow each other the kind of the freedom to do whatever, because it's more an arrangement than a sentimental attachment, right? And there are parts of the book that take place in somewhere called Nest County, which kind of seems like an idealized version of, well, maybe not idealized, actually. I mean, it's a version of kind of the barren countryside, but the emotional relationship of it to the characters, or the kind of emotional meaning of it within the world of this novel, is pretty ambiguous. So it's a very hard novel to summarize, and it's not a novel that really has much interest in laying out its themes for you, or really giving you any kind of clear signpost as to what it all means, or even really like the kind of structure or format of how you're supposed to make meaning from it, right? It reminds me a little bit of, just in terms of things that we've talked about on this podcast before, it reminds me maybe a bit of Pynchon's Against the Day, in the sense that it has what Chris, you might have called back in the day, like kind of a rhizomatic structure, right, where you have all these kinds of branching connected things with no clear center. So, that's kind of my introduction to the structure and idea and format of the novel. I guess I'm just curious, first of all, I have some research that I did about different people's perspectives on how her writing works. I have some questions about what, if anything, you guys were able to pull out of this. But I'm just curious to start with, like, at a just kind of a personal subjective level, what were your first responses to reading this? What struck you about it? How did you feel about it? Patrick?
If I'm being honest, George Orwell once wrote an essay about book reviewing, and he kind of talked about how book reviewing is a, in some senses, is kind of a practice that is a lot about lying, because most of the books you read, you just don't have any reaction to. So how do you review a book that you feel nothing about? And I'd say that's the situation I'm in right now. Like, I just, you know, I feel very little about this book. Like, yeah, I mean, there are some questions that I have, but it just did very little for me. And yeah, which is why I was really hoping, you know, you guys had strong opinions and strong reactions, because I think partly, like, it did little for me because it is, like, there might be a lot of cultural difference that I'm trying to contend with that, you know, kind of is a barrier for me. But I don't know what the book is saying about love in the new millennium. I don't know, like, this book doesn't even feel like it takes place in the new millennium to me. I mean, it sure feels more like it's in the 40s or 50s or something like that. So, yeah. Maybe Chris would be.
I'm curious what you thought, Chris.
I sort of felt like this book made human behavior make as much sense as, like, observing this book made the practice of observing human behavior, the characters' behaviors in this book, feel like watching sea monkeys flit around in a little, like, and I don't know if I entirely mean that as like that sounds very harsh. It just is sort of like, why is Sui Lan doing this? Why is Weibo doing this? There's so many different characters that sort of like behave inconstantly. It seems like they're each is wrestling with deep, like what they express to be deep concerns or deep abiding concerns. Mr. Yao has like this fear of death and the underworld that is somehow attached to some very mysterious things that he does that I'm not quite sure I understand, and all that to say that, like, on a sentence level, there were things that I really, really enjoyed, I guess, like moment by moment. Patrick, you mentioned that there was, that this doesn't seem like it takes place in the new millennium, right? But there is a McDonald's. And as soon as like the McDonald's popped up, it made me laugh, and maybe that's like how low the bar got set for me. But I didn't feel like I understood the characters' behaviors, and there was something kind of maybe almost mysterious and beautiful about a mysterious. I won't say beautiful. There was something mysterious and alluring about just all of these different characters behaving in ways that I didn't quite understand, like Weibo is going to be shot in prison because he's got cholera, and then he runs, and then the guy who's going to shoot him throws a coat over him and says like, you ran in a circle and you don't have cholera, and just like stuff where like
that's like the way that you described that just now is like, it's like if you know, like if you're talking to a child and they're talking about like the story that's yes. happening in like the yeah. game that they're playing with their action figures, right? Like, well, he had cholera and they were going to shoot him, but then he ran in a circle and they threw a coat on him and they said, oh, you don't have cholera. Yes, and I don't exactly. mean that at all in a disrespectful way to make that comparison, right? But the kind of, you know, I did as much reading as I could really find and research as I could really find about other people's thoughts about this work, right? And it does seem like, you know, one thing that I read is that she tends to write things. I mean, she describes herself as an experimental author, right? And she tends to write things without a lot of editing, according to, you know, the things that I read about her. She tends to kind of write things front to back without a lot of editing work. And so, I, you know, when I make that comparison to kind of like a child improvising a story about toys, it sounds like part of what she's doing is almost kind of a more sophisticated version of that kind of like unedited, free-flowing kind of structure, right? I think that there are probably ways, you know, we've mentioned the cultural context for this, right? And the ways that we might be alienated from this by culture. And I do certainly think that there are some barriers that an English-speaking reader is going to have with the translated version. And I do want to talk a little bit about what those are and why those have the effect that they do. I do also think that, I mean, I think there are things structurally that make this confusing to think about or talk about that are not cross-cultural, right? I think that, you know, a Chinese-speaking reader reading the original, I suspect, would still find this somewhat bewildering for some of the same reasons that we do, mm. right? I saw a video of a reading that she did where the author, it was at the Asian American Writers Workshop, and the director of that workshop, Kin Chin, gave a little bit of his thoughts about how to approach her work, right, in the introduction to her reading. And he said that he finds her harder to describe even than most experimental writing. And he picked up on a quote that she said, which is, all modernist art is performance art. And I'm roughly paraphrasing his words here because it was a video, so I couldn't really get a, you know, clear transcription. But what he said is that when you think of performance art, you think of something that is in the body and that is gestural, right? And that he thinks of Kan Sui's work as a fusion of a bipolar sensibility between kind of avant-garde modernism and dance, right? So like, it's like dance or performance in the sense that it's embodied, gestural, and dance-like, but at the same time, it has the kind of intellectual and angular and plastic and abstract qualities of modernist experimentation. He says that it's a gesture, but an analytical gesture, right? That performance is a type of vitality, the body in motion in relationship to an audience, and that vitality explains the contradictory aspects of the work, right? So, like, the ways that, like, she has cited the influence of Kafka, right? But she says that she loves Kafka not just for his existential despair, but for the sense of pleasant freedom that his works evoke, right? Does any of that help crack this open at all? And again, that's all coming from Ken Chin of the Asian American Writers Workshop. That seems like the most compelling... That seems like the most compelling description of her method and of how to relate to her work that I could think of. And yet at the same time, I don't know if it helps me. So does any of that mean anything to you guys or help at all?
I think the idea of dance and performance make like... When you say that, it makes sense to me, though I'm not sure how or why. Like, you might be able to describe the way Kansue moves between characters' viewpoints as a kind of dance, and you might be able to describe her distance from the characters as performative. Like the fact that she's so distant from the characters makes their actions seem more performative. Does that seem reasonable?
I think so, yeah.
I would say, I mean, like, is it kind of going back to what struck me? There were several points in the novel where it seemed as though a character felt very strongly about something one way and then would just abruptly change their mind or feel very different about it. I mean, like, that, I feel like that was a recurring thing, such that it seemed as though, like, the convictions of these characters was not as important. Like, in a novel, in like a narrative arc where we're invested in, like, a character sort of like facing a problem, internal, external, and then kind of overcoming it. It felt like the dance, if you could call it that, was sort of almost not disregarding the characters, but like playing with or around their, you know, the kind of like the things that, you know, would, I don't know how to say it, but it seems as though it's not just, I'd say that the characters aren't dancing for me, Patrick. It's, I don't know, Kansue.
Isn't that how you said it, Hans?
The video that I watched of the Asian American Writers Workshop, it was pronounced Kansue.
Kansue. It feels like Kansue is the one dancing, and that these characters don't, their story arcs are not as important as the play. And I'm not sure what this, I guess, like, that's where I get lost, like what that play is, because, and maybe that's a cultural thing, you know? Yes, there's like all these characters, they are dealing with a bunch of different lovers. They're all in a very mercurial reality where, spatially things don't make sense. I think that there's a tree behind the prison that's not behind the prison, but is behind the prison, that is close to where Soylan's parents live, something like that. And it's that inconstancy actually is sort of reflected in, at least for me, I don't know if you guys felt this way either, in the characters themselves, in a way that the characters were not some sort of, were not dancing for me so much as Kan Sui was through all of these elements. And I don't know what that dance or that play was. I didn't get it. Mm. I enjoyed snippets of it. Like snippets of it seemed sort of like the Aurora Borealis, just to sort of like randomly feel mysterious and interesting. I feel like the for me, the most cohesive bit was near the end with the students on the, in the, what is it? They're studying the Gobi Desert geography, the geography of the Gobi Desert. And the Dr. Yeo finds himself out there. And there was like this kind of like weird like thing, this thing that happened there that was like, I don't know what's happening. And I don't know how, if she's earned this or it's just something that like has come about organically or what. But I really enjoy what's happening right now. And then basically that happened in a lot of chaos for me. So I guess... I don't know. Does that? I'd say Kan Sui is the dancer here, in my opinion, and almost nothing else seems to have the constancy to be an agent like that. At least for me and how I read the book.
So there are a couple things that I was thinking about while you were talking. I really want to make sure that we don't lose the idea of the relationship to dance, because I do have a couple more thoughts about that. I was also thinking, you know, you mentioned the inconstancy of the characters, right? And the way that they seem to care deeply about something in one section and then kind of discard that care or act in ways that seem irrational if they care about what they say they care about, right? Or they just do things and we don't know why. And it made me think of, I mean, that's how people are to some extent, right? Like people do, in fact, in the real world, care about something and then stop caring and not really understand why, you know, or act in ways that don't make any sense relative to the cares that they have previously said that they have, you know? And I think that that is something that tends to often not be represented in fiction, right? That tendency is often not represented in fiction because fiction requires some sense of cause and effect to be... Fiction requires some sense of cause and effect to be satisfying, right? In most cases, for the most part. Character-based cause and effect. Right. And I wonder... It makes me think a little bit of a comment, you know, when we were all studying writing with David Krauss, I remember he mentioned that in younger writing students, there's often a tendency to write stories where a bunch of stuff just happens, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean anything or follow any kind of conventional line. And when you talk about it in a workshop, the writer will say, well, that's how life is. Things just happen and it doesn't mean anything. And it mostly nothing is actually that connected to anything else. And it's like, yes, that's accurate, but it's still not necessarily artistically satisfying to see that turned into fiction, right? The point of fiction is to render that chaos into order. Do you think that is it appropriate to think of what she's doing here as maybe partly a much more advanced version of that tendency that David Krauss was talking about, you know, of kind of trying to suggest the actual chaotic nature of human life?
Maybe. I think when I said that this book was like watching Sea Monkeys, I think that in a way that is a kind of a potentially a clever effect where the behavior of people becomes sort of alien or you have a hard time projecting a cohesive narrative of meaning onto what's going on. That, and it doesn't, and for that to happen, and I still, you know, I still occasionally, I think it was hard to do so, and I don't know that this is a novel that really tries to make you empathize with the characters, you know, that much. But I still felt, you know, connected to some of them at different points. And for that to be something that kind of coexisted with the fact where they, I was sort of watching them and mystified by them the way that I would be mystified by the behavior of, you know, feral pack creatures, you know, like, I don't know why did, you know, I thought that they were a couple and now she's with this other person. And Suh, there's like a moment where Suh is brought to, oh man, it's right before she gets the pass, the city pass. She is with some sort of gangster. She's out with him. And then another gangster shows up. And he's really nasty to her. But then they have sex, and she feels like she loves him, and all of that. There's a weird effect. You said it, Hans, where it's like that's actually like there's a way to tell that what I just that kind of short summary that I just did poorly, where it's really affecting, and it's like, you know, we're not rational beings. We're not consistent beings. But then the story becomes about why she kind of goes against her better nature, or goes against, you know, why did she sort of betray her love, her feelings for this other gangster? Why did she, you know, suddenly, where did her feelings come from that she suddenly felt for this other person who wasn't very nice to her? And it's interesting that this book seems really explicitly uninterested in exploring those questions.
I was just going to ask, if the book is uninterested in exploring these kinds of questions, does this go back to the idea of performance? Just because whenever I hear the term performance, I don't know about you guys, but the connotations that always come to me when people say art is performative, or identity is performative, or the novel is performative, it's that, you know, performance is a show, performance is a display, and most versions of performance don't have anything under it. You know, performance is an act.
Yeah.
It is something that is beautiful but also hollow. So maybe like a no play where you know, everything is about pageantry and movement, and but there aren't any real emotions to latch onto. Is that a connection? Is that,
or like the term performative allyship, right? Where like people perform a certain kind of virtue on the internet or in a public space, but it's about the performance, right, rather than the underlying feeling. I think,
right,
there might be something to explore there. I think when I think about the relationship of when I think about this in relationship to performance, what comes up for me almost is more, and this goes back to having read that she tends to write sequentially without editing, right? Meaning like she starts writing at page one, she stops writing at page 260. She writes things in the order that they appear when you read through the book, right? And that she doesn't edit. And what that makes me think of is jazz, right? Like if you think of this novel as a jazz performance.
Right.
And I'm like going to connect it to jazz, a couple different things in music, right? I'm going to connect it to experimental jazz. And it made me think also a bit about things that I've read about the actual, like the difficulty of atonal composition, right? Of writing something atonally, meaning that you don't have any clear harmonic center and you're not following any kind of standard harmonic rules, right? And it's actually difficult to write atonally. Well, and the thing is that like your brain is so used to like conventional harmony and resolution that it will drag you into, if you're trying to write atonally, your brain will drag you into those conventional patterns. So you have to like, you know, the pioneering atonal composers would, through various means, would carefully track to make sure that they were using all 12 notes in roughly equal measure, right? And I feel like to write a novel like this would almost be, it would involve some of the same kind of mental effort as atonal composition, right? Where if you're setting out to write something without a conventional protagonist or a conventional narrative structure, there would be a certain kind of effort involved in keeping the novel from drifting into those things because of the familiarity of those patterns in our brains. So when I think about her writing this novel, right, it feels like atonal jazz, right? It's like sitting down and kind of spinning this story in this kind of free, relaxed way, similar to how a child would improvise a story about their toys, while at the same time consciously trying to avoid falling into those conventional patterns of character and narrative resolution, right? And I like that conceptually, right? It's an interesting formal idea. I don't know how much aesthetic joy I can draw out of it, you know? And I'm not a huge fan of atonal composition or experimental jazz, so it might not be flattering to compare the novel to that, but at least it kind of helps me think about what's happening here structurally.
Yeah. That brought to my mind like this is the, you know, you said this is like atonal experimental jazz, and conceptually I find it interesting too, but I don't particularly like listening to experimental jazz. I actually really like the exact opposite. So something like Terry Riley's In C, where like the whole point of the album is for you to focus to the nitty gritty on one scale or one root note. All I'm saying is I'm saying what you said, Hans, in a different way, that this novel is like the opposite of Terry Riley's In C. If either of you are familiar with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I wonder, like, one of the questions that I had sent you guys ahead of reading, one question I'd sent you guys ahead of this discussion, most of which we haven't touched on and may not touch on, but one question that I had was, like, the just most dumb, obvious question of what does this say about love in the new millennium, right? And is it thematically significant? You know, these characters kind of all have these like passing, shallow, romantic sometimes, but in a very kind of unpredictable, mercurial way. The fact that these loves and passions and flings and relationships, the fact that they have the quality of atonal jazz, right? That these people are all kind of improvising without an emotional center. Can that be read as a statement on love in the new millennium?
Probably. I mean, I've got to think so, right? Like, I'd love imagine, in the new millennium is inconstant, various, full of all 12 notes.
Inconstant, right? Arbitrary. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And it is interesting. I mean, you had mentioned, Patrick, that this might as well not be in the new millennium, right? And so it's interesting,
right,
that
it's
interesting that, I mean, I think if you were to think about like writing, if somebody were to say to me, you know, I'm going to pay you $10,000 to write a novel called Love in the New Millennium, the thing that I wrote would probably mostly just be about like it would entirely be about technology, right? I mean, it would be about OkCupid and Tinder and, you know, Zoom sex and all that shit, right? Most of the whatever kind of like social or cultural trends you would try to document in the novel would be downstream of technology, right? And it's very interesting that this novel focuses entirely. I mean, if you think of that kind of structural quality as reflecting the philosophical or emotional nature of love in the new millennium, it's fascinating to me that it's approached those questions kind of entirely from a sort of spiritual, philosophical standpoint rather than a technological one. It's interesting that technology is so absent from the description of that experience.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, like, for being in the new millennium, it doesn't mention technology. Chris, you said there's a McDonald's mentioned one time, but otherwise it all seems very anachronistic. Like, there is a brothel. Like, who, like, there aren't any brothels anymore. That, like, brothels are online, you know, like OnlyFans and things like that. These are the, you know, and sites where you can find escorts or whatnot. So it's very, very interesting that technology isn't mentioned. And I'm not sure what my point is. It just seems very, very, very strange to me that these are the decisions the author has made. And also, okay, I remember what I was going to say. You asked a question, Hans, about how the synopsis describes this novel as about surveillance and paranoia. And, like, if this were really about surveillance and paranoia and it's in the new millennium, then you definitely have to talk about technology. So I think, to answer your question, I think that synopsis is utter bullshit. Like, I read the synopsis and I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And then I read, and then, you know, like, I did, needless to say, I did not think it was great.
So it wasn't great. It wasn't great for you, Patrick?
No. I mean, I'm actually enjoying our conversation about it. Like, oftentimes when I don't like something, the conversation is slightly less stimulating, but no, this is a good conversation, even though the book was not great, as far as I'm concerned. Well, it's interesting conceptually, but it wasn't enjoyable for me to read. Let me put it that way. You know, maybe it is great, though.
Yeah, just I have to think. I mean, just a quick thought about the synopsis saying that this is about surveillance and paranoia. I have to assume that comes from, like, I mean, when people in America and Europe think about contemporary life in China, right? Like, our sense of life there is very, very dominated by what we hear about surveillance and paranoia, right? So I would imagine that there's a lot of that bias. Either that synopsis is appealing to the knowledge of that bias or written from that bias, right? But yeah, if there are themes of those things here, I was not able to pick them up. Sorry, Chris, what were you going to say?
You mentioned you brought up technology, but is it really? I mean, I think that it's fair to maybe broaden what this might be saying about love in the new millennium to include just sort of like any conceptual or symbolic connections to life as it is now. And Patrick, you mentioned the brothel. And there's this theme, at least early on. I think it definitely came back. I think that these women, they worked at the soap factory And then they started to move to be, several of them moved to become sex workers. Mm. And then they seemed very fulfilled by that, that shift in their lives. And it, like that they were seeking it out for one reason or another. And then at the end of the book, it seems as though, it's not something where like occasionally it's brought up that these women are perceived as, or are being, dismissed as fallen women, but they don't think of themselves as that. And that never really, that fallen woman thing never really bears out that I could see. It seems as though, this is, you know, one more of those kind of like moves that they make in this book that is not necessarily like consistent with how people might behave in reality as we think we know it, or as we sort of expect it in stories. But they seem to want to live this life, and it's attached to this, to, and it seems like to me, like an evolving sense of what love is and how it needs to, you know, how, what love, you know, should be in their lives. And also, there is this, I think it's said twice, and I thought of you, Patrick, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. But there's these things, these kind of like,
you thought of me cause I'm a fucking Marxist.
Yeah. Cause you're a Marxist. But there's these broad shapes of things that feel like they could be symbolic. You know, they're, you know, is there an economy of love? Is that economy different now than it was before in some way that encourages a kind of, again, back with inconstancy, and but like the willingness to just sort of connect, you know, to love anybody, you know, whether you respect them, find them attractive, whether you even like them, and I don't know, does that, Hans, connect for you with any like thematic consistency? Because I think that the problem is like thematic consistency, like, you know, is there a thematic consistency here? Are there meanings to be made out of anything in this book at all about what it might be saying about love? I feel like there are little passages, there are little scenes that could be that are interesting little like prisms to sort of like observe the world through, but I don't know if it's saying anything consistent. Does that match with how you think about it, or
is it an obvious cop out to say that the lack of thematic consistency is thematic? I mean, that's, if David, again,
David Cross would love that response. Like,
I did. Well, it on and again, purpose. I mean, you have to be careful with. Obviously, you have to be careful with saying like it's very easy if you're making fun of a critic who says something like that, right? It's very easy to boil that down in a mocking way to, I don't understand it, so the fact that it's not understandable must be the point, right? Or if you're making fun of the writer, it's very easy to say, well, there is no point, so the lack of a point must be a point, right? But I do also think that, like, I mean, that kind of slipperiness isn't, it's not easy, right? It's not easy to be that slippery. It's not easy to... If we're interested in the idea of inconstancy or emotional shallowness, it's not necessarily easy to write fiction that replicates that kind of inconstancy and emotional shallowness in the same way, right? Ultimately, as far as, I mean, I do think that I'm a little bit handicapped in, I think we're all a little bit handicapped in our ability to affirmatively say, like, this is what this is saying about love in the 21st century, maybe because of those cultural differences that we're talking about, right? Because I don't have, I mean, to be able to reductively say this is what this is saying about love in the 21st century, you have to, like, that contains the implication that things were different 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago, right? And I don't know how much, I mean, if there's a sense of shallowness and inconstancy and kind of focus on emotional surface in contemporary Chinese romantic life, you know, to focus on that contains the assumption that up until some undefined recent point, romances and loves and relationships were held in a much more kind of conventional, what we would think of as, like, with greater emotional depth or with greater emotional constancy or in ways which were more narratively conventional, right? And right. I mean, I don't know if that's...
Well, that doesn't seem to be the case.
I don't know. I don't know enough to say affirmatively, right? I mean, I don't think that would be the case in the West, right? Like, I'm not convinced that, you know, people 100 years ago or 50 years ago were any more romantic or emotionally predictable or, you know, commitment focused than they are now, right? I mean, you can track trends in things like, you know, divorce statistics or something like that. But, like, I mean, I think at any point in history, people have tended to assume that people who lived in the past were more romantically conventional and traditional and commitment based than they actually were, right? And, you know, whatever constraints there were, whatever differences there are in, you know, people's habits around those things probably mainly just have to do with loosening of social or political controls. So, I mean, I do think if the point that we're kind of inching toward is that a sense of chaos, shallowness, surface level focus, inconstancy, that those things are characteristic of love in the new millennium and that is replicated in the structure of the text. I like that, and I have to think that that's an accurate and good reading to some extent, but I'm also, it's one of those things, I think, where if you boil it down too much to an easily explicable point, it might become kind of fragile and weak.
My question is, so, like, I like that conceptually, like, I like that as a reading of the novel, like, the weird structure in the dance, the movement from character to character, the performative nature of it is a representation of the shallowness and arbitrariness and inconstancy of, you know, human relationships. What that leads me to, though, is, well, why don't we just write this like a Jane Austen novel without the happy ending? You know, because in Austen's novels, I'm just picking her arbitrarily. Like, I'm sure we could pick any other writer, you know, in her novels, there are all kinds of inconstant, shallow people who, you know, impregnate women before they're married and make them, you know, a scandal. There are men who, you know, make promises and then don't keep them. There are buffoons who women marry just so that they can have some sense of security. So why don't we just do something like that and just not have a happy ending? Like, you know, our main character ends up with a buffoon so that she can be, you know, have some money and have her needs taken care of, but always be unhappy. You know, why not do this in a different way?
Well, and this is not really a textual answer, right? This is an extra textual answer, but I suppose the extra textual answer is because Kansue is as interested in form and process as she is in theme, if not perhaps significantly more interested in form and process than theme, right? That's like asking, right. Well, why didn't Jane Austen experiment with the William Burroughs cut-up technique, right?
All right, fair enough. Dumb question, my bad.
No, I don't think it is a dumb question. I think it's actually an excellent point, right? I mean, I think that, like, the subtext of your point is that it's interesting to try to dig into this stuff, but, like, it's interesting to try to dig into what the novelist's saying thematically, but I think you also have to be aware at the same time that if it really wanted to be that thematic, it probably wouldn't behave the way that it does, right? I mean, I think the point that you make is a really good reminder of that, right?
Right.
I have a question too. Is Kansue successful as a writer because people like to read her work, or is she successful because people want, because of it, I how to ask this, like, not to diminish the novel, I think that we have complicated feelings about it. It's hard for me to imagine, you know, it's very interesting for me to imagine that, you know, that she's, you know, successful doing this, and that, you know, and I guess, like, we haven't read, I read part of one of her other books actually, and it was a little bit different. It was the one that came out, maybe like 12 or 13 years ago. I just kind of downloaded the first chapter on Kindle and read through it. And I thought it was kind of, you know, bewitching and mysterious, but I also, you know, just didn't feel any desire to continue reading it. And I guess, like, I don't know, like, is performance art, you know, like, and avant-garde, you know, art that is, you know, sort of dismissive of, like, the, like, a lot of the traditional means by which you compel people to enjoy and purchase it and seek you out and continue to allow you to make a career of it. It's interesting to me. Just say it explicitly. I don't know what in this is compelling to people to continue to return to the well. If this is her trick, because once you've read it, it feels like it, you know, it's just more of the same. And I think that, you know, Patrick, you say, like, you know, why not just have the theme bear itself out in a more traditional story? You know, I think that's because, as Han says, the theme is not as important as, like, the experimentation. And it's hard for me to imagine the experimentation being interesting book after book after book. So I don't know. I guess I am being very cold, but I really didn't hate this book. I just don't know, you know, I don't know if I could return to Kansue again.
Right. And it really makes me wonder, like I don't get it. How does something like this get published? It's just not, I mean, it's certainly not bad writing. It's just not, it's not enjoyable. Like, you know, it's not enjoyable to like dive into.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that might to some extent come back to cultural things, right? I mean, I think the way that it gets published in English is it gets a reputation in China, right? Like she's, I mean, I assume that she's, you know, well regarded within kind of like the whole network of, you know, there's, I don't know shit about China really, you know, but like, I assume that just like any other country, there's like a certain small minority of people who are very interested in cutting edge literature, right? And she achieves success within that. And then there's some small minority of people throughout the world who are interested in cutting edge experimental literature. And I can't, as to how this would gain, how this would get published and achieve prominence within China, I do think that, like, I think there are some things that would be very similar about reading this in translation. I think there are other, or reading this not in translation, rather. I do think maybe there are other things that would not be the same reading it not in translation. And, right. I mean, it's, I don't know. I think it's kind of, to us, like, the question of how did this get published and get prominence in China is kind of unknowable and unfathomable.
Yeah,
not,
I mean,
you
that,
know,
that's fair. Yeah.
Not because it's totally not, you know, fair. I mean, there are lots of people who would know and fathom it. It's not because it's an unknowable question. We're just not in a position where we can understand it with the level of sophistication that would be required, you know? I read this.
All I know about China is what I learned from an international student in the writing center who liked to talk about her homeland.
The reason that
go ahead.
I was just going to say, the reason that I bought this, I don't know if either of you saw a movie that came out in, I think, 2018, maybe 2019, or might have come to the U.S. in 2019. I don't know if either of you saw a movie called Long Day's Journey Into Night.
I think I heard of it.
So it's if you imagine, so imagine like Andrei Tarkovsky and David Lynch collaborating on a Chinese noir. But like, and that sounds like it's overselling it, but it's actually not, right? Like if you imagine what that would be like and then make that really like live up to the promise of that idea. And I
live
really
up to the
really...
promise of being totally unwatchable. Is that what you mean?
Well, you have to assume that you like Tarkovsky and Lynch, right? And when I say Tarkovsky and Lynch, I mean the
I do like them both.
When I say Tarkovsky and Lynch, I mean the kind of slow painterly interest of Tarkovsky and the dreamlike qualities of Lynch, right? The way that Lynch actually employs dreamlike surrealism in a convincing way, right? Like, take those techniques and apply them to a Chinese noir. I thought it, I mean, it really was very, very, it was marvelous. It was magnificent. I really, really enjoyed it. And I just, it, I kind of thought, you know, like, are there other things in China which are interested in, is there other art coming out of China which is interested in these qualities of surrealism and experimentation, right? You know, like I lived in South Korea for a year, right? And I did not get the sense from, you know, my time there that there's any particular amount of surrealist experimental art coming out of South Korea, right? Like that tradition really has not taken root in that country, for instance, right? But I thought, well, are there, how many other people are there doing things like this, right? And that led me to this book. So to the question of like, how does this get an audience? I mean, I think that if you can tap into some of that kind of sensibility, you know, and I actually, I do actually plan to reread this. Like I probably will reread this as soon as I have time to read something, you know, not because I think I'm going to make any more sense out of it, but because, I'm just curious, like coming back and going through it again, like having thought about the structure of it, having a sense, like knowing what it's doing while I'm reading it instead of knowing what it's doing after I'm done reading it. And also, frankly, just like having notes about who's who, so I don't spend quite so much time like puzzling over all these names. I'll be interested in seeing if there are things that resonate or connections or sense that can be made out of it without coming to it totally cold, right? And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do personally think it'll be interesting to go back through. I'm sure that there would be diminishing returns, right? I mean, I think there are generally diminishing returns. Like, one hard lesson that I learned in grad school was that there are generally diminishing returns for any experimental writer, right? Like, anybody who's,
right,
and actually for that matter, even for like not that experimental writers. So if you pick anybody and you read all their books, you know, front to back over a couple of years, you're going to get pretty severe diminishing returns. There's a blurb on this, like my edition has a blurb actually from Robert Coover. I did that with Robert Coover and experienced severe diminishing returns. So I don't know that I'm going to read anything else of hers anytime real soon. All right. Well, I feel like that takes us to a pretty good, if not a point of resolution, then a point of exhaustion. Do you guys have... anything else you wanted to add about it before we wind down? All right. So thank you much, everybody, for listening to our podcast on Con Sway's Love in the New Millennium.
Nope.
If you have read this and you have any thoughts about it, feel free to reach out. Hit us up. I'm sure there's a link or something somewhere that'll tell you how to do that. And we'll talk to you all in a couple weeks when we're going to be covering Philip K. Dick's A Scanner Darkly.